Okay, so look, today's topic is Phase F. I didn't get a chance to write it on the board, but Phase F is called Direct Information Models and Experience. So it's not just about interviewing. Interviewing is just one of the ways to get direct information and experience. So the goal of this is I've gained direct information, models, and experience not readily available from other sources. So when you think of interviewing, you might have felt like you were interviewing your initial informants. Well, maybe you were. You were calling up on the phone. You had questions. That might be an interview. But what's really involved here is using that gift of someone else talking to you to get information you can't easily get by other ways. So you really don't want to end an interview and afterwards say, oh, I really needed to ask this person this and I didn't get time or I didn't make time or I didn't prepare or I let time go away. You want to really focus on what it is that you can't easily get from other sources, where other sources are these days what's written or what's on the web. Another way of saying that is before you interview someone, you really want to be well prepared about what their work they've done. But really, it's not just that's a kind of courtesy. So, you know, as much as people like talking about themselves, it's not the best use of your time when you can read it. But it's also allowing you to define what it is you need to get from them. What you get from them may be from an interview, it may be from observing, participating in a workshop, maybe from observing a workshop they're running. So in class, we're going to do Phase F in terms of interviews, but that's not the only way you get information. You may be saying, look, I've still got reading to do. I'm not ready to interview anyone. That's okay. I just think it's appropriate to have this phase now and keep it up your sleeve. Some of you may say, look, I'm not sure who I'm going to interview. Yep, well, it may emerge in 5 weeks' time. It may work, you know, you realize there are just some issues you can't understand unless you see how it's done. You know, for example, in Karen's project, she's with a principal, and now she's working with university school partnerships. And what's the word you use? A disconnect. There's a disconnect between what they say they're going to do and what they do. Well, people don't always write about the disconnects. They keep writing about their ideals, about how the way it's supposed to work. And principals are busy and they're probably too polite when it comes to university researchers. You know, maybe sometimes when they're just talking, principals are talking amongst each other, they say, you know, that this person from Harvard is, you know, full of it, but they might not publish it. They might not ever get to publish it. You know, in fact, I remember, this is an analogy, this is a separate topic, I remember once someone saying that, who's the woman at school on the hill?
Charter?
But the kind of leader of it. She's Deborah Meyer?
Deborah Mayer.
So she gets to write a lot.
She
gets to write a lot, and people know about her ideas about schools. But that you talk to people and say, but so-and-so is doing a whole lot more. But partly because they're doing a whole lot more, they never get to write about it. So if you meet so-and-so or visit their school, you'll actually see even more than you'll see in a Deborah Mayer school. But it's because they don't get to write about it.
I know her personally, so.
I was just bringing up as an example, but so there you are. So, so connections are often helpful, actually, to get access to someone who's busy. Okay, so trying to get information you can't easily get from other means, and, you know, Mike's...
I have an example.
Oh, you have an example?
I have an example.
Yep.
Then this would give credit also to, because Peter put me in touch with someone at his college that had a model that I was really interested in. And I read up on what the college did, but I was wondering what the difference between sort of what the college is going to put out there and what the real world experience is like. Because you know there's going to be some difference there. And he was really great because he could fill in the gaps that I could see in the writing. Like, so where are the real challenges in this and what are the real difficulties? And so it really complemented what I was reading, but it gave me stuff that I wouldn't have found in the beginning.
Yeah. You know, sometimes people actually do write about it. And I, in one of my comments back to, it's actually to Karen, I realized I'd read a book. I don't know how I came across this book, but it's called Laura and Jim and What They Taught Me About the Gap Between Educational Theory and Practice. So this person went and did a study by interviewing the people at the university about what they said they were doing and then what, you know, what their theory was, what they actually did when they went to schools. They went to schools and they got them to talk about what their theory is and then what they actually did. And so it's all about Laura. Laura must be. I forget who Laura and Jim are, sometimes people do publish about the gaps, but it's not often done. And sometimes people publish about the wonderful workshops they run, but they don't necessarily tell you about all the stumbling efforts they made and how they began and how no one came to their first workshop and how they got over that. And that kind of experience is what you would quite like to know, you know, as you face this area of trying to do something different, to engage in the world. You know, Noreen's trying to look at embedding support into a classroom, and it sounds like a really good idea, but if she could just talk to someone who tried it and their class bombed the first semester and then they got back on the horse and fixed it up, that might just be a really good addition. Okay, so that's what Phase F is about. And so I got you to, well, I asked you to prepare these 5 questions. I'm sorry I didn't email to remind you. If you haven't done them, you can do them in the class today. But these 5 questions were questions that you couldn't easily get answers by other means. So I'm going to use those. Later I'm going to ask you to use those 5 questions to prepare something called an interview guide. But right now, has anyone got the 5 questions in front of them and prepared to share 1 or 2 of them?
Okay. So eventually my employment when we go together is in chasing each other is a fellow named Peter who attended the Al Gore conference. And
the Al Gore conference was when?
Well, last year.
Here in Boston?
Yeah. So my first question, I really want to know how you felt. So can you give me an overview of what you felt when you came away from this conference?
And you need to know that because?
I need to know that.
No, it's true that she couldn't easily get that by other means, that answer to that question. Because people haven't necessarily written about their feelings, so there might be blogs that talk about that. But I'm asking a separate thing. Why does she need to know that to move ahead in her project?
I think I wanted to just find out if he, you know, because as I'm researching and so forth, I'm learning new things and it's shifting me. And I just wanted to see if he went in and came out surprised at the impact it had on him, if he went in and he was disappointed that it wasn't substantive. You know, just sort of to commiserate maybe a little bit about someone going in and experiencing the process and their review of that process. And it's kind of an opening introduction to just dialoguing about the actual event, which is what I'm interviewing about.
Right, so we'll get back to the interview and the actual event in a second. So the interesting paradox comes up here. I actually don't think that's a phase out kind of question. I think it's a question where you're trying to build a relationship with someone and you're trying to learn more stuff. It's more like a phase A question, like just checking out whether your subject audience and purpose of your project is exactly right. You're kind of like getting some extra input. And I stress from very early on, have these conversations with people, share your work. Sharing was one of the early weeks. So I say keep sharing and share with people like this person, Peter. So I'm not saying don't ask people that question.
Oh,
I'm
maybe
just saying go for phase F, though. In order, Jody's project is about learning about international negotiations. how people actually do that. What's the process? What are the different approaches people use to them so that she can be conversant in that? And also about the issue. So a phase F kind of question for you would be what we're talking about today, you know, here's what the book says about the process, yet what's the process always has this backstory. And so you'd be finding out about the backstory in negotiations, not in an outdoor conference, in negotiations. So that would be my phase F kind of question.
Well, I ended up with seven questions, but the second one is, do you think the issue is more a debate about whether climate change is caused significantly by human actions, real or not, or is it the debate more heavily about what to do about it, or is the debate something else?
Right. So these are questions that are important to you. And maybe as you see the questions you ask, it may actually sort of say, well, maybe my focus isn't just about learning about how you do negotiations, it's about the bigger issue. So then you've got to check. If you sort of see, you know, asking about people's responses to climate change doesn't feel to me like what you said your project was about. But when you find yourself writing that, you have to say, well, maybe that's because my project description has to shift, because that's what I really want to do. So better to admit it. But if it's just, you know, if you're just asking these questions because you are actually interested in having this conversation with him, make sure you also include the questions you couldn't easily get by other means, you know, like, which might just include, do you know people who have been involved in negotiations who can actually talk to me about what it's really like? Because maybe you don't at the moment, but this person does. Other volunteers to be put through my manual?
It's always fun. I actually like all my questions, so I hope you don't dislike them. But I said, if you had a whiteboard and unlimited resources to create the perfect infrastructure and system, what would it look like?
A whiteboard being one of these computer
whiteboards? No, whatever. If you had a blank slate.
Oh, one of these whiteboards.
Anyway, you're in a brainstorming session.
Okay. Sorry, what was this question to?
This is going to be to someone in a school who has done what I'm hoping that I'm going to be doing, or... You don't like that question, I can say, what specific ways has the use of technology enhanced creative and collaborative learning? So very specifically, not just broadly that, you know, increase in motivation or what have you, but any specifics.
In your school?
Yes. To a particular person in a school, I'm asking this question. So in what ways has it enhanced it?
You know, it's...
Can we
try another one? No, it's good. It's good, but it also allows me to talk a bit about how interviews are really interesting things, because if someone's been a big booster for using technology in schools, they've probably practiced doing it. They had to get grants to do it. They had to convince the principal to do it and so on. So it could be you could press the button that says, yeah, rehearse that old script. And in a way, what you really want, because that script is probably already written in some articles or in some proposal that they give you copies of. What you really want is how it really happened. And so the specific examples can allow you to say, so did the students, did all the students get that? Or and then you can really get into the concrete and then they start to be honest. So when I was teaching undergraduates, one of the students was very interested in tracking in schools, tracking where people, or streaming, where people are put into streams according to their abilities. And I was living in Ithaca in upstate New York at the time, a very liberal city and school district, and their policy was they did not have tracking. So when he interviewed the people, they of course told him about that policy. But he's now a professor of anthropology, so he clearly had a way of getting people to talk. And so when the interview was over, he would keep going with them. And they would start to tell him about how so-and-so always gets the good students. There's no tracking how so-and-so always gets the good students. Or so-and-so always arranges to teach this class where they get the good students. And so eventually, if they talked long enough, he'd still have the tape recorder on. He would say, he might even say, so it sounds like you have tracking. And I would say, yeah, we do really. We know policies against it. So it was only because he got into the specifics and got beyond the script that they actually got the information that he really needed, which is what is it really like to be in these schools that officially don't have tracking. So that's great when you can get that. And it's also the opposite of great. When you find you've done this, you know, in my research, I was at one stage of studying people who tried to connect ecology of the science and anthropology of people in East Africa called nomadic pastoralists. You know, they spent a lot of their time moving around with their herds where the find which it's a pasture after it's rained. And my first interview was at a university, and then I was going to spend most of the next 2 days at a research institute. And so at the university, I interviewed this guy and had really good questions, probing questions, found out stuff. Must have spent a couple of hours. And then when this guy's name was Mike McCabe, and then when I went to the research institute and during break or someone, they said, did you get Mike to tell you about his campfire stories? I had no idea, but this guy, Mike, was the guy who could get people talking and telling the historical stories, and he learned the language well enough that he could really get at what it really meant to live this lifestyle. You know, even though he was part of this team that was measuring the production of grasses and growth of cattle herds and all this quantitative stuff, he was the one who could really get this. And I had no idea. And I wasn't going back to that city, so I wasn't going to get to do that side of the interview. And it really would have fleshed out what I found from him. Which led me to be very impressed when a couple of years later, I got my colleagues who did a lot more interviewing than I did to come and talk about interviewing in classes. And this interview guide, which I'm going to give you in a second, but it's also linked to the syllabus on the website, ends with the questions. 11, are there key people you think I should talk with here or elsewhere? That's not, are there key things you think I should have talked about? But then question 12, is there anything I didn't ask you about that I should have asked you about? Now maybe Mike McCabe wouldn't have said, you need to ask me about the way I tell stories, because it didn't seem to be the topic. But there's at least an openness at the end to admitting that your plans, what you think you need to ask about, isn't necessarily the thing. And at this research institute, too, the person who was my host, I saw him at the beginning, of course, and I saw him at the end, and we were kind of wrapping things up. I was going to catch the shuttle bus to the airport and so on. And I must have, in effect, asked this kind of question. And he said, well, yeah, there's something I want to ask you. Who's paying you to do this? Which is an interesting question. I could just tell him the answer. You know, I had a little extra grant from the fellowship and so on. But the whole time, he would arrange this visit, time to have it around him, but he was still like, who's paying this person? What should we be telling him and what shouldn't we? You know, what is he a spy kind of question, you know? Because they just want, even if they're anthropologists, they weren't used to the idea that someone would do anthropology of scientists, would actually observe scientists. So he was like, there was some distance, some barriers that I only found out about at the end. So that was too late again. Anyway, so here's this interview guide. Gina, do you have this? It should be linked to the...
Thank you.
Yeah. It's not like you're really going to study history. You've got to spend. Yeah, sure.
Does the interview have to be towards someone or with someone who sort of has been through it? Because I was thinking about interviewing sort of like staff in my area as to why to haven't worked for them, to sort of get a sense of that. So I guess I was thinking, of, could the interview be more of a survey to get the pulse on the school?
Yeah, look, I haven't mentioned this, but surveys would be another thing we could do on the basis, couldn't we? And designing a survey so you get the right answers is an important thing. If you design survey questions instead of an interview guide, that's fine. And one of the things I'll say to you is don't ask a question that could in theory have a yes or no answer in your survey, but I'd also say that in your interview. And I always, at this class, get some people upset because I always say, if you want to see how not to do an interview, listen to Terry Gross. I listen to her far too much because of the time it's on the radio. But I'm always, you know, she's got her questions. And they often go on and on and on, and they say, and you've, you know, and in your book, you've talked about how you used to beat your kids and so, and now you're reformed and you're no longer an alcoholic. So what was that like?
10.
She's already told it all, you know. So, but then she'll ask questions that where the person could, if they were just honest, just say yes or no. She doesn't want a yes or no, so she wants to get them to talk. So ask a question that actually, you know, we know because we have an interaction. You know, interviews aren't a natural form of interaction, and when we interact with people, you might say, well, what do you think about the global, you know, do you think, what was your question about the global warming? We often say, do you think global warming's caused by happening? And when you say that to someone, you're not actually interested in knowing whether they think it's happening or not. You're interested in getting in a conversation about how much they're influenced, whether they saw Al Gore's movie, how much they're influenced by it, how much they're starting to be skeptical of scientists. You're interested in a lot of things. So I would say try to work out an interview guide that reminds you of the things you're really interested in, and you don't end up with someone actually answering no to you and going on to the next question. Because that's the other thing I hate about Terry Gross. It's a person will say very personal, important things, and she'll go to the next question on her list. Like, didn't you hear what this person just said? Respond to it. Maybe because she's interviewing a person and they're across the other side of the country or something, but some people can do it, but at least the guy on point. Tom Ashcroft.
How much
was
that on point?
He just acknowledges it, even when he doesn't agree, and
he does respond.
Oh boy, does he respond to what they said? I think he is so.
What's his name?
Tom.
He's sharp.
Yeah.
Sharp and human.
It's on in the morning. The replays again. At, I think 9 or 10. It's on.
Like Oprah.
But it's not. Anyway, so okay, let's look at this interview guide. So an interview guide is. In a survey, the person is answering all the questions you've set, and you're trying to get, you know, a lot of different people to answer exactly the same question so you can add up the numbers who said yes and no and or whatever. But an interview, I think of an interview as being each one is different. But a guide is to at least remind you to get back to some of the questions that you might want to ask. You might forget because of where the thing goes, to allow yourself to know that you've got the questions to get back to if you, so you don't have to be anxious. You can let it go off for a while. It's also to make sure you set it up at the very beginning so the parameters are clear. I mean, if you're interviewing someone and they're thinking, is this going to take 2 hours? Or is it, I don't have very much time. The half hour you've got with them won't be very well used, but if you say now we've got half an hour now, maybe you should always arrange that kind of thing beforehand so you know, but sometimes when you thought you had an hour, the person says, well, actually, no, I've actually only got half an hour now, so then you have to regroup, but at least you're on the same page and you can just use this time. Often when people say they only have half an hour, if they're really into it, they give you more time. They push back the other people. So what have we got in this interview guide? This was an interview about something called cold fusion, which was an idea that you could get fusion energy without enormous temperatures like you have in the sun. And for a brief period in 1990, it looked possible. So these people myself with someone called Bruce Lowenstein and Tom Garrett were interviewing a lot of the scientists. So, introductory comments. I'd like to use this interview to collect your recollections about the cold fusion period. And he's saying the material might be good for the archive. And but then he says, for now, what I'm most interested in is your memories of how your own involvement in cold fusion developed. So he's introduced it, framed it. You might have already told them what you're interested in on the phone, but now you remind them, so they're here. So what's he done next? First, I'd like some quick background information about your training and current position. So question eight, do you have a CV that lists that? And if they do, then you can get that and you don't have to go through any of this rest. But otherwise, you can just quickly go through the rest. Then what he's done in under three, he said, now let's go back to the third week of March of this year. Try to remember what you're thinking about then. So this is often I'm not saying all your interviews have to go this way, but a chronological interview is often a very interesting way to get people talking and organizing their thoughts as against asking this question, then that question, then that question, and they answer dutifully, but it doesn't really add up to anything. By getting them to talk chronologically, you can often just sit back and listen as they go through. Sometimes I've done chronological interviews and the person goes way off or goes fast forwards, and then you can just say, you listen to them and then you can say, okay, can we go back to 1980 now? Well, let's go back to 1980. Or you look at your notes and say, can I take you back to 1980? And then you can fill it in. So the fact that you start chronologically doesn't mean you actually have to continue chronologically. But it is, when I say interviews aren't a natural thing for people to do, they're a very unnatural way. You know, to get someone's attention, to be answering questions to someone, it's just not the way we interact, we interrupt, we don't have one person defining what the subject is. You know, I don't know how often you've been in arguments where you say, that's not what we're arguing about. And the other person says, well, what I'm arguing about now, you know, is people change the terms. And that's what happens in real life. But in interviews, because it's not natural, you try to define what it's about and bring people back to it. But to make it feel natural, then doing these things like getting them to talk about things chronologically, like a story, makes it feel more comfortable. Okay, so then they ask particular questions. And then they ask you to looking back on the whole episode. That's number 10. So in a way that some of you have done either in 618 in the summer or with me in 693, you've done ORID, which is a form of questioning that you might do with a group where O is objective, R is reflective, I is interpretive, and D is decisional. And so it's good to get out the sort of the objective stuff, the stuff that isn't too colored, before you ask people for their interpretation of what it's all about, their bottom line. You get the detail before you invite them to say yes or no about whether they believe in global warming, human induced global warming. You actually get all the different details.
Can you say those objectives?
Reflective, interpretive, and decisional.
ORID.
It's like horrid, but it's horrid. Now, where would you find out more about that? If you look, I think in the strategic personal planning, it had actually a link to something called focused conversations or mention ORID. But if you can't find the link, focused conversation is not. If you're doing this, one of these ORID things with a group, decisional is what the group then decides to do.
The action.
Yeah. That's not really relevant to this.
Right.
But it's really saying, get out the facts, get out what they're really doing, you know, get them to talk about what they were doing in the third week of March and the fourth week of March and so on, before you get them to tell you their bottom line. Their bottom line kind of sweeps away that detail and isn't as interesting as what comes up. So then, as I've already said before, ask them, are there key people you think I should talk about? Ask them to fill in the holes that they might have been just politely letting you ask the questions, but then when you ask them these final questions, they get to say, well, you really need to talk about storytelling around the campfire or whatever. Okay. So I've asked you to prepare five questions you can't easily get the answers for. So somewhere in between the introduction and getting the background information and these final questions, what should I ask? You've got to feed in those questions. And Sandra tonight isn't here because she had a chance to go to some lecture with some session with pharmacists where she could ask them, she hopes, ask some questions that relate to her project. So I said, go off and do that. And she sent me the questions this afternoon. And they're all good questions, but I sent it back to her, moving around the order. You know, there were like seven questions. They're all relevant. And if you had someone, they could answer them all. But I said, let's ask the questions. It's a little bit like ORID. Let's ask the questions that are fairly objective, aren't going to get them upset if they sense that you disagree with them, and then move through to things where they're critical, where they've tried to change things. So I put them in an order that had a flow. So I'll try to do that when you send me questions too. There's no particular rules of it, except to say, try to think about a flow of questions, and imagine that you were being interviewed. This would be my guideline to try and work out the order. Imagine that you're being interviewed. What a series of questions would help you make sense of your own life? You know, if you were someone who was in this whole cold fusion area, you'd probably be, you know, if you're a scientist, you're probably really busy, and maybe the media has been calling you up, and you're trying to really sort out what's happened. Just to let yourself go through the steps and notice the way your view of the situation developed kind of helps you make sense of yourself. It's kind of the interview is almost a gift to you if they allow you that time. It's not quite a reflection, but it's a step towards a reflection on your own experience. So if you can think of an interview that in a way where the person actually enjoys it because they're got to make some sense of the looming, buzzing confusion of their life, then that's a good interview. Questions, thoughts, experience, maybe some of you have done interviews. Tips from interviews?
I have a question. If we want to do some type of a survey, do you have suggestions for how will we use the same kind of questions? Or
I actually think surveys, if they're designed in an order that helps someone make sense of them, get better, richer answers. So obviously I'm biased towards surveys that where the person is responding with text. So this little mid-semester self-assessment, you'll see mid-semester things from other departments if you're doing courses with other departments where they ask you to say, you know, is it going well or not? They'll ask you these things. Well, I don't think you learn, as an instructor, you learn anything from those. But conversely, when you all write your different things, I have to read them all and I have to, like, synthesize them. I have to notice that some people like what some people like, other people hate. And then I have to deal, I don't dismiss both of you. I have to work out some way to actually live with both of those. So it actually takes more work to digest, but it's sometimes surveys are really only valuable if you could have big, huge sample sizes, which you probably don't have time to get. So the qualitative one, you can
actually... So you need a survey like where people are answering questions with full sentences, not like circle yes or no or those kind of things.
Yeah, that's my bias towards questions sort of like this thing where you actually have to write in text. Yeah, but even then, the order of questions can really help going from the more the objective to the ones where they might reflect to then give some interpretations.
Would you suggest giving the questions beforehand so that they can reflect?
Sometimes people ask me for those because they're so used to being ambushed by the media and so on. So you've got to go along with that. But other times I think it's just a matter of how much time you can be getting from this person. Sometimes if people see these questions and they go to very deep issues by the end, they think, oh, I wouldn't know what to say at the end. But if they go through with you in real time through the questions, they start to answer those questions. So I don't have a fixed rule. There are other things I do have fixed rules about. We often feel uncomfortable about taping. Even sometimes when I take my tape recorder, someone welcomes you in and then they start chatting with you and I don't interrupt them, and afterwards I always regret it. Because I just find myself distracted, like I should be writing this point down or something. By having it taped, I can relax and just go with the flow. But to do that taping, it accentuates that this is not a natural situation to interview. So you've got to like set it up, maybe ask them before when you're arranging the interview, but on the day saying, okay, it's still okay for me to take this? And they say yes. And you say, well, just give me a moment. Because so many times I've, even taken this class, I press the button on the little tape recorder and then started talking, and I haven't noticed that I didn't press it the right way and the light wasn't on, and then I hadn't taped. And in the old days, the batteries would run out. I hadn't put the batteries in or something like that. So, or the tape. You just need to say, okay, so just give me a moment. I just want to get this right. So you're not sitting there interviewing them and thinking, did I get that tape in the right way or not? Because you're not. It'll show in the way your eyes are meeting theirs, and the interview won't work as well. So this unnatural thing about taping it, you just got to get it set up and do it. Now, you might say, well, what if they say, well, what are you going to use it for? You've got an easy out. You're doing a student term paper. You're not writing for the Boston Globe or something. But in the course materials, there's a sample release form, so you can adapt that and use it. So you can, because you're just doing interviews as a class project, you're not going to go through human subjects, which would take forever, and you would have to, wouldn't get to do any interviews this semester. So just act like you're doing an interview like for a newspaper while you're not doing it for a newspaper, and give them a release form. So they can say, look, I don't want you to quote me unless I see the transcript. You often find that that's not a problem, because you don't actually end up wanting to quote me. Paraphrase, you get the overall impression, you're not citing particular people, it's not that important. Yep, no? You guys? No?
I was going to ask, you had people who've done a combination of surveys and interviews, because I could see reaching out to someone, and particularly somebody you cannot visit, and to either do it over the phone, or you could say, well, I could also email you a survey, link to a survey monkey if you could fill that out for me. Have you had that people do that?
Yeah, these days are not with Survey Monkey and stuff like that. They're it's certainly easier. But we use Survey Monkey or Survey Gizmo for doing some evaluation. Some of you might have had it in the online course last semester. And we find that some people don't get to the end. So they lose steam. They click on the link and they start. So you're really asking for someone. These days, I think with all the flutter in an email inbox, you're really asking for not getting information from people by using online survey stuff. So sometimes people say, look, can you just call me up and let's talk it through? It's a relief, a break from having to type onto the computer. But it's true that sometimes there's information that really doesn't require an interview, you just want to get a number of people answers. So you can do that. I think that, what do I say about this? It's always important, another rule, to do a pilot survey. In pilot meaning you do it with a few, test it out with a few people. Pilot interview. Because you think your question in a survey is clear to you, but the world of answerers finds all sorts of meanings you never intended, or finds meanings you thought should have thought about, and you want them to be exposed before you use them a lot. So it takes time. Pilot interviews also give you a chance to hear yourself speak, and then you realize some of your script is a bit wooden and you change it. You practice doing these various things. That's what I'm going to try to do today, unless we run out of time. Get you to practice, you know, write a script and then practice setting up with each other. You know, get the other, pair up and get the other person to be, tell them who they are, and then they can just pretend. And then go through these stages of setting up, maybe asking one or two questions and then finishing it up. If you practice the beginning, like when you do a talk, usually